There is a very strong impulse in the American character not only to swim against the stream, but swim directly over dry land. Although I guess now you do that with a Hummer. Maybe we're evolving this idea that freedom means untrammeled will. You know, the corporate CEO who seems a model of normalcy, but kind of wears the brass knuckles of the Hell's Angel. If Microsoft is the ultimate manifestation of a successful counterculture, you know, Bill Gates has done for money what Jack Kerouac did for words. Just made a whole lot of it.
Next story. Well, our apologies to at least a few million people we have not included here, but some of the more intriguing ones have been documented by the person we're talking to next. When you've been browsing through the bookstore, you may have seen some little strange volumes over the years. Modern Primitives, Angry Women, Modern Pagans, The Atrocity Exhibition, and picked them up and riffled through them and thought, is this for real? Well, the publisher is for real. This is our conversation with The Veil.
Yeah. You're doing a test.
You just get a level.
You're going to hold it the whole time?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Well, this is a luxury right now where I actually have something to put my elbow on.
Holy cow.
And it also means that if somebody like the last one starts yelling, I can do this.
Oh, the last person started yelling?
He started. Well, he was imitating the guy who shot him, you know, who was yelling, "What's the matter with you? Why aren't you dead?"
Wow, now there's a line I hope never to have to speak.
So, just
yeah, okay, yeah, V. Veil here, yeah. Research Publications, yeah. San Francisco. Yeah. So are we rolling?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay, sure.
His writing name is V. Veil. He's in a crowded office apartment, a small staff going in and out in North Beach, San Francisco, where he's lived for years. Years ago, he was given $100 by Allen Ginsberg and another by Lawrence Ferlinghetti to publish his first magazine, Search and Destroy. 20 years or so ago, he began publishing Research, a series that's chronicled the cultural underground, the radical fringe, the counterculture. V. Veil. I asked, why do you not use a first name?
I should have a soundbite answer for that. But Marcel Duchamp said that the essential component of a work of art is mystery. And I thought, well, if I had the name V. Veil, people would be asking me, what does the V stand for? And if I never told them, that would just be a mini mystery. But most people call me Veil, however. Veil was my given name at birth. My mother said I was born in a green valley, and she poeticized it. And I only pretty recently realized that I've sort of been privileged, or whatever the word is, to be both counterculture and an outsider from day one, almost before I was born. My father was one of the only Japanese-American or Asian-American beatniks before the beat scene happened. He happened to, before Kerouac had even published, he was in New York City in the same class with Kerouac, and they became friends, and they hung out at a bar, and they had this brainstorming about how, let's start a literary magazine, and they found someone to put up $2,500, but then at the last second, the person withdrew the money, and it didn't get published. But I thought, gee, my dad could have been the first person ever to publish Kerouac. It was in the fifth grade that I started doing very serious reading. I bought, like, Great Dialogues of Plato. And you can read that when you're in the fifth grade. At least you used to be able to, because I sure did. And I also read, the second book I read was The Story of Philosophy. I mean, these are books that I bought myself. And they were in the fifth grade. My mom was smart enough to move me to a very, very small desert town because she knew on welfare, I mean, you know, how can you live? You can't live on welfare, but if you go to a small enough town where no one wants to live and it's 120 degrees in the summer, then you can get really low rent. But you know, the whole time of all this, I was Japanese. I was Japanese-American. My mom and I were the only Asians in the small town. And there, I remember there was like one black family in the town. I think only one so-called Latino or Mexican-American family in the town. And there was me and my mom, and I think everyone else was white. It was a very small town. No bookstore, of course, but it was in the fifth grade that I also learned to mail order. And so I could start getting books. I remember early on I got a book on yoga, and I tried to teach myself that. And another book on Zen, Buddhism. I was just interested in other ways of thinking after reading The Story of Philosophy. And I was a wannabe beatnik when I was very young, but of course it wasn't really possible in the desert town. But somehow I'd gotten a hold of Hal, and more importantly, the Life magazine that was pictorial, that was all about beatnik lifestyle with really nice black and white pictures and actually pretty decent text, actually very fair-minded text in that. So I, like, memorized that Life magazine. And but, you know, I came to San Francisco, and I went to UC Berkeley, and then when I graduated, I joined a band in the 60s called Blue Cheer, and they're considered the father of heavy metal music. But at the time, they started out with six people trying to be a Paul Butterfield blues band ripoff. But the whole time I've been in these bands and been in all these things, I mean, there's an aspect of me which has always been an outsider, which I realized partly from being Japanese-American. I mean, I wouldn't say that I wasn't accepted, but let's put it this way. I'd probably still be a virgin today if the hippie movement hadn't happened. So I was very grateful that that happened. And then I went to work at City Lights. And at City Lights, it was really great because I could meet all... if I had heroes, I could meet them. I thought I wanted to be like a poet or writer, but then the stuff that was coming out was really bad, the writing, that is, of mine. And punk rock started, and I knew that this was the next big thing after the hippies. And having lived through the 60s, I don't really think I've seen any great documentation of the 60s, because the hippie movement was so complex. And so that's why I did Search and Destroy, which is some people consider the best documentation of the punk movement, even though it was just in San Francisco.
Search and Destroy was a tabloid mostly of interviews with people who were the direct perpetrators of the movement, modeled on Andy Warhol's Interview.
He would, like, print their entire interview unedited. And they were amazing. And I said, this is what I'm going to do for the punk rock cultural revolution uprising, except I'm going to edit. Because I wanted them to be funny and enlightening and provocative and inspiring and all that. But some of the interviews in Warhol's Interview were just a little too unedited, too self-indulgent. I kind of wanted more of an emphasis on ideas. There was a lot of innovation by either accident or sort of not being kind of ignorant of the conventions of quote-unquote good graphic design. All the risks that were taken and all the things that were done with collage and, you know, ripping and tearing things and putting them together and using a lot of just plain blacks and just deliberately using photos that had been unscreened so all the tones would drop out. And just doing things because we could, and we didn't have any money anyway. And so when you're in an atmosphere like that with a bunch of people sort of reinventing their cultural universe and just going all wild, I mean, when you have all this permission to do any kind of innovation and everyone around you is encouraging it and virtually no one's going, oh, that looks ugly. I mean, all the standards for ugly and beautiful were completely kind of upended or tossed out the window. Well, the punk scene, though, changed. And again, it was in San Francisco, it changed literally overnight with the program that was broadcasted in late 1978 called NBC Weekend. And they did a special on punk rock. And they showed all these people being very violent and, I don't know, you could see blood. And it was a completely different from the punk rock underground that I knew. The unfortunate effect was that there was only one club in town called the Mabuhay Gardens, and the very next night, literally, I think the program aired on a Friday night, and the very next night, Saturday night, there was a punk show I went to go to. I couldn't get into my own club. There were like about 1,000 mostly underage young boys in white t-shirts waiting in line to get into this club, literally around 2 blocks. And I was like appalled because these kids naturally, since they didn't read and they just saw this one NBC weekend program, they imitated the worst pseudo-violent aspects. And violence was always just theater in punk. Punk has always been associated by straight media with violence, but it wasn't violent at all, I think. It was like, yeah, sure, you would throw popcorn maybe at someone, but I mean, how much is that going to hurt you, be hit by popcorn? Because I consider the punk rock movement to have been a massive international naive art movement. Having lived through it, I would say it was an amazing time when you could see everyone buying cheap clothes at thrift stores. They were much cheaper then. You could buy a 50s prom dress for a quarter in the 70s. No one wanted it. And then you could rip and tear it and paint it different colors and put stencil slogans on it or glue on some provocative picture out of a magazine. I mean, it was an amazing amount of creativity in that area alone. And when bands would play, a fair number of people would make posters for them, not because they were told to, just because they liked the band and they wanted to do something, even if they weren't in a band. And of course, it turned out that practically everybody in the original punk rock scene, including me, was in a band, at least for a while. Well, I started research because I think I'm a slow learner, and it took me a long time to realize. Here I was publishing this tabloid Search and Destroy. We sent copies all over the world, but it was like we didn't have the money to make the long-distance phone calls to Australia to try to collect, or London. So we virtually never got paid for any copies sold except in San Francisco and Berkeley. We could afford to collect from the local Bay Area. And I finally realized, hey, you work at City Lights, and they have their own distributor and wholesaler and everything, and if you could just get a little more money together to put out something that looked like a book, then they would do all that horrible distribution and collecting. And so that's exactly what I did, and I never looked back. And I still think that every research book is informed by and continues the mission of the punk rock cultural revolution, which was trying to remap culture entirely again. On a different aesthetic, really, a different set of standards, which were informed by, you might say, radical politics. I mean, the emphasis, in my publishing at least, is more on art and creativity, but it does not ignore, you know, you might call it radical political envisioning or theory or history.
Over several decades, research has published documentation on body piercing and modification, neo-paganism, radical feminist performers, incredibly strange films, incredibly strange music, J.G. Ballard, William Burroughs, freaks, subversives, bodily fluids, the list goes on. I've rarely interviewed anyone who's done a great deal of interviewing. So what about interviews?
From Burroughs I got this notion ages ago of the third mind, and that's when any two people, no matter who they are, talk, there's the potential that arises for a third mind to be there that's kind of bigger than both of them. And you could say the holy grail in any conversation is when an idea gets thought of for the very first time right then and there in real time, that, or some kind of putting together of an idea. And then it gets explored in real time, and you have a new thought, more or less. Although we know it's very hard to come up with new thoughts. You can go like months without a new thought, and I'm actually very happy any day that I learn a new word. I don't know if a word qualifies as being a thought, but I love learning new words, and I'm always learning them every day. It's so frustrating. The two living people that I managed to have some kind of relationship with, i.e. as close as we're talking now, for like hours or days, were William Burroughs and J.G. Ballard. And I've managed to do a book on each. And actually, I've done 3 books on Ballard, and I'm about to do a 4th one. That Burroughs and Ballard, you hardly have to edit a word they say. They are just, it just comes out in perfect sentences. They're just so amazing, partly because that's all they do is, you know, is that they write and they read and they talk. And they've just, I like that thing about Kerouac, the legend that was that before he was 18, he'd already written 1 million words. And I think there's no substitute for reading, writing, and talking. You have to do a lot of it before you start to get good at it.
And I asked, well, if you were interviewing yourself, what questions would you ask? And he didn't exactly answer, but I always find whatever answers I get a lot more interesting than the questions I ask.
Well, I think it's only lately that I've thought that I might be interesting at all. So I could say, yeah, for a lot of reasons. I guess it is interesting to be an outsider and to have been an insider participant in so many cultures and, you know, been in the same room and in the same car with, like, Neil Cassidy. He used to come to our rehearsals in the Blue Cheer Band. And to, you know, have Allen Ginsberg give me my first $100 to publish and Ferlinghetti give me my second $100. And to have just, you know, been at the first acid test at Longshoreman's Hall and all the way up to, I don't know, punk rock, of course. And I suppose that's interesting. I just think that, like Andy Warhol said, work is the most important thing. Work is everything. I kind of go along with that because there's not enough people with discipline and vision doing kind of countercultural publishing and trying to keep these certain ideas alive and trying to synthesize. And with Ballard is, both Ballard and Burroughs are both futurists. They talk about what's going to happen in the future, not just what's describing what's happening now. And I love that because I guess it was Bucky Fuller or somebody said, I'm interested in the future because I'm going to spend the rest of my life there.
In San Francisco, we were talking with V. Vale. His website is www.researchpubs.com. And the publications are found there and at many independent bookstores. I don't know if they're carried by the major biggies, but then why are you shopping there anyway?
You know, I connect very powerfully with Vale's description of himself as an outsider, even when being on the inside. For me, that's not on account of my ethnic background. I don't think I never had a strong consciousness of being a Bavarian peasant American. Well, maybe I do. I've always felt very much over at the edge of whichever of the multiplicity of social milieus we've been part of. And so I wanted to finish with a story. This is a fictional story coming from a novel that we wrote called Realists. If you would like to read Realists, well, you can't. It's not published. We're trying.
But this is a moment on the Blue Terrapin bus, a thinly disguised version of the Green Tortoise. If you haven't traveled on the Green Tortoise, well, there's still time. But picking up and going back through a retrospective with the driver, this is Smokey.
Smokey knew that there was a plan behind the universe. Spirituality had never been at the center of his life, unless that was the same as chasing women, but it flickered around the edges. He had been raised Presbyterian, left the church in his teens, yet still valued that faith for having given him no coherent beliefs whatever. That was the best foundation you could have. He'd sampled various religious paths and felt some affinity with the Native American stuff, where the women were a lot foxier than at Quaker meeting. But he never could buy that business about Earth being a big turtle. Maybe he was just too literal-minded. He remembered flunking a high school quiz about the difference between a simile, a metaphor, and whatever the other damn thing was. Now, this had been the source of strife between himself and Shadow, the love of his life. They'd had a long, sumptuous night of peyote erotics, and in a mellow hour of early dawn, he'd asked, "Why do you believe that crap?" It was a joke, but she didn't laugh. He'd driven the pickup to town, and when he got back, his bags, guitar, and a fifth of wild turkey were in the driveway. His last parting shot at the woman in the doorway was, "It ain't a goddamn turtle." Since then, he'd spent years on cross-country drives, staring ahead to the rolling plains, the crested mountains, the cloud ballets, both classical and modern. Smokey drove on. His mind wandered back over a life of missed rendezvous with destiny. He was, what, 65, 66? So he'd been about 14 when he'd seen Woodstock on TV in Scranton, Pennsylvania. That pretty much ended his interest in church or school as the locus of his sex drive. He could run away and be a hippie and find out all about it. Over the next 4 years, he looked for his cue to run away from Miss Ketter's Algebra 2, Mr. Stolke's American Civ, Mrs. Tippett's English Lit, but it never came. His parents didn't mistreat him, so he didn't have that excuse. The few long hairs at Scranton High were as image-conscious as the jocks and disdained his short-clipped locks. He'd gone to a couple of sparse anti-war rallies in town to see if he could get laid, but all the girls were either too old for him or looked very grim. He longed for graduation, when he could either dodge the draft or join the Army. He didn't care which. He was against Vietnam, but figured that if he could bring the same capabilities to military service as he brought to Algebra II, that might serve the cause of peace. But the draft ended before his number came up, so he had no excuse. He graduated, got a job at the post office, and watched TV a lot. Looking back, he realized how passive he'd been. He'd married Estelle because she asked him to, left when she told him to, agreed he'd been a bastard, yes, but a quiescent one. About once a month, he'd make some excuse to go to New York and pay to get laid. He stopped looking in the mirror, even to shave. When Estelle kicked him out, he started to grow his hair long. He thought they might fire him. He had no good excuse to quit the post office, but if they fired him, he'd be free. They were too damn tolerant. His mother said, "Don't come into this house with that long hair," but relented. Just kept telling him he looked like his Aunt Halima. He started to get drunk a lot. Smokey shook his head to scatter the memories, but they kept settling like the snow in that winter paperweight. Why remember the miserable 70s? Reminiscing was something you did when you had somebody with you in bed and you could cuddle and she'd say, "Poor baby, not behind the wheel, not tonight, not alone." What had saved Smokey from death in Scranton was an ad in the Village Voice. "Ride the Blue Terrapin," it said. 14 days, New York to San Francisco. You'd bunk on the bus, you'd all pitch in to cook, you'd meet girls with long hair and full lips and gaps between their teeth. He sent for a brochure, put it in his top drawer, forgot about it, except in his dreams. 3 years later, he had his first streak of good luck. His dad died, his mom went nuts, and he was fired for being drunk. Dad left him a little money, and the day after he was canned, he called the Blue Terrapin to see if it still existed. He made a reservation, bought a guitar, which he couldn't play, and stepped aboard his future. The first day out from New York, he sat on the U-shaped bench seat at the back of the bus beside a black-haired, olive-skinned girl who was talking with a thin, perk-breasted albino woman, maybe early 30s, in some foreign language. They turned to him, and the olive sizzler asked him in a heavy accent, "What's your name?" "Smokey," replied Arnold Luntz. Why Smokey? He didn't smoke. Maybe it sounded Wild West. All he knew was that he'd never get to first base with either girl as Arnold Luntz. And it worked. Within 3 days, he'd made love with the slurry-hipped olive beauty and with the red-eyed spasmodic albino, ecstatically, repeatedly, all for free. And then he'd gone right on through the passenger list. It wasn't really the name that did it, he knew. It was the countryside, the freeway, the trees, rivers, and the distant glistening towns in the night. For the first time, he was mad with the liquor of freedom, and his face shone. At each rest stop, Arnold spoke to the burnished steel mirror. Hello, Smokey. 3 years later, after 2 more trips, he became a driver on the Blue Terrapin. It wasn't easy. You had to be a good mechanic for those decrepit beasts, you had to be a master cook to manage the communal cookouts, and you needed a license to drive the thing. He worked at it, faked it, and finally landed a job. Now it was 30-some years. Over the years, Smokey had taken a couple of breaks for marriages and other mishaps. He'd had trips where he didn't remember what happened after Chicago. Trips where faces glowed with that surge of wonder he'd seen in his own reflection. And he'd seen his own face change. He'd known riches and loss, roads that used to be there, women disappearing out from under him. He'd spent a night with Angie under the desert stars. She blew up her air mattress, and they tried to make love, but Angie was over 200 pounds and took up most of the mattress. He climbed aboard, but she wiggled like crazy, so he was rolling off her, then flopping off the edge of the mattress. And they laughed and laughed, and he never consummated a damn thing. But he suddenly realized that sex was supposed to be like this. It was supposed to be fun. This trip was going to be different. He could feel it. Not because most of his passengers had vanished into the night and others taken their place, but because, for the first time in many years, he'd seen in the darkness the face of Shadow, and she'd said very clearly, yes.
That was a chapter from Realists by Bishop and Fuller. And if you're not familiar with our inspiration for the Blue Terrapin, go on, check it out, www.greentortoise.com.
Next time, 3 stories about wounding and healing, a presidential interpreter, a faith healer, and, well, what do you do when you hear a loud sound, turn around, and realize that a man has just shot you?
And if you're in the Bay Area, our live performance party, the Hitchhiker's Cabaret Cauldron, continues the final Friday of every month.
It's wonderful.
Email us for information, info@hitching.org.
Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by the Independent Eye. Visit www.hitching.org, where you can listen to 3 entire years of shows, buy CDs of the shows, and some wonderful anthologies.
And join the Hitchhikers Guild. Please help support the continued existence of this show on the air.
Special thanks this month, for no special reason, to our webmaster, Eli Bishop, who lives in San Francisco, works as a nurse, sometimes a programmer, happens to be our son, and is also a marvelously funny and evocative cartoonist. You can look at some of his work at www.graphesthesia.com.
This is Elizabeth Fuller.
And Conrad Bishop. Peace and joy.
I did a lot of stuff with the Tibetan monks. The Grateful Dead would get them on tours throughout the United States. And when they came up to the Northwest, I'd get asked to cook and hang out with them and take care of them. What a great experience that was. I mean, they're funsters, you know, they're pranksters in their own scene. I came away with feeling that there's equal parts of spirit and humor. Too much spirit it gets sort of boring. Too much humor, you're a silly man, nobody takes you seriously. So there's a fine line. If you walk it right in between, it's this perfect harmony.